Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to another edition of Valley Writers Read. And tonight, we're really delighted to feature two authors with two quite different stories. Our first story is written by Anne DeVigo and is entitled Fault Lines. And our second story is written by Lucille Epcar with the title Who Spanked J.R. Jr.? But let's get back to that first story. To begin our show, here is Anne DeVigo reading Fault Lines.
Fault Lines. Spencerville Road ran straight north from Highway 46, through a valley flanked by green, treeless hills. It was a narrow road, only wide enough for one car, and pocked with cracks and holes like the face of the moon. Barbed wire fences marched along both sides so close they seemed to imprison the station wagon on the broken asphalt.
"Let's not," Sally said. "We can go back."
Trevor pulled the lighter from the dashboard and touched its hot red end to his Camel cigarette. "You accept it, Sal. It's too late." His cheeks flattened as he inhaled.
"It won't be terrible if we stand them up. We're never going to see them again."
She cranked the window down to release the smoky fug. In back, the baby began to cry, short, fretful whimpers, accompanied by the thump of his feet against his toddler seat. She looked over her shoulder.
"Bailey, what's wrong with Tango?"
"I don't know."
Bailey tucked his head behind the cover of his Hardy Boys mystery. He'd been withdrawn since she told him they were moving again, this time from Paso Robles to Fresno. Tango's wails escalated until the noise beat at her eardrums. Sal knelt and leaned over the seat back, absorbing in her knees the lurching of the car. Tears and snot ran down Tango's fat cheeks into his mouth. She retrieved his bottle from the floor. There was no tissue in her pocket, and impatient to make him happy, she licked the dirt and cookie crumbs off the nipple. Saliva killed germs, didn't it? When she offered it to him, he batted her hand away. She sank onto her butt, pulling at the grit on her tongue. When Bailey was a baby, he'd been mellow, so easy to please that she mistakenly assumed it was due to her good mothering. With Tango, she felt as though she were in a dark room, stubbing her toes on the furniture. The station wagon's wheel slammed into a pothole, and her stomach thumped the seat back.
"Trevor, for God's sake!"
"Couldn't help it. There hasn't been a road crew out here for at least 10 years.
He flicked the ashes out the wind wing and put his hand back on the wheel. Sal faced front again, rubbing her stomach. It was tender, and she wanted to cry. To distract herself, she stared past the fences to the pastures, thick with knee-high grass and dotted with grazing cattle. Calves tilted their heads and sucked from their mother's udders with small, thrusting motions, as if saying, "Yes, yes, more." After a few miles, the road passed the tall rock columns and ostentatious metal arch of the Toby Ranch. Its private driveway, black and smooth compared to the county road, led to a Spanish-style house whose white walls were dazzlingly bright in the June sun.
"Leland told me his grandfather owned this entire valley at one time, including the Toby place," Trevor said. 15 miles from 46 to the grade."
"But Leland let it slip through his fingers," Sal said.
"Not all his fault. He said his father lost some. Bailey tapped her on the shoulder.
Mom, Tango's standing up.
You little devil, how did you get out? The thin plastic belt lay slack at Tango's feet. He teetered on his fat legs in a shuffling dance motion that earned him his nickname. As Sal settled him, he resumed his crying.
One thing about Leland and Edwina, they're crazy about Tango, Trevor said.
And I'm not.
He shrugged.
Tango is a surrogate, a baby for Edwina because she couldn't have children, Sal said. Edwina didn't say so, but I suspect Leland's not all that well-equipped between the legs.
Nice.
She turned her shoulder to him.
Why was it she always ended up regretting acts of charity? She'd begun with good intentions, accepting Edwina's invitation. Leland and Edwina doted on Tango while they tended him in the church nursery, but they weren't the type of people Sal sought out. Their air of failure made her want to look away. Leland's home haircut left his bangs sliding crookedly over his forehead, and his huge Adam's apple bobbed like Gomer Pyle's on the Andy Griffith Show. Edwina had a hare lip. When she smiled, her scarred lip skewed upward, revealing a wide expanse of pink gum above her teeth.
"We want to have you out to the farm for supper before you leave us," Edwina had said, and there'd been something forlorn about her that moved Sal to accept. As the days passed, Sal's charitable instinct evaporated, replaced by irritation. Today was the last day before the moving truck arrived, and she was wasting it on Edwina and Leland. Loose boards rattled as they crossed the bridge at Little Shalam Creek. She'd read about this spot where the infamous San Andreas Fault was marked with a road sign. The Temblor Range reared up in front of them, the mountains gold in the sun, divided by the great purple scar of the fault. She could feel the Pacific and North American plates grind at each other, creeping inches at a time, dueling for supremacy. Sharp needles of tension pricked the air.
There was a big one here 2 years ago. Leland's place was pretty much wrecked, Trevor said.
He turned into a driveway, past fields enclosed by sagging wire. At the end of the lane sat a one-story frame house. Leland's farm staggered out from the house in various stages of disintegration. A grain chute dropped its parts in the farmyard, and two harvesters in the right-hand field were covered with a scaly coat of rust. A water tank lay prostrate, and beyond it a barn cast off its weathered boards and galvanized roof into a pile of wood and metal. Trevor braked in the farm's turnaround with the motor still running. The air was hot, and the smell of manure burned Sal's nostrils.
I don't like this place.
Bailey rolled down the window and let in a couple of enormous flies, which flew around Sal's head, bumping her cheeks with their solid bodies. The back door of the house flew open. Edwina and Leland burst out, almost running to the car. Tango stood up again.
Oh, my! Oh, my!
Edwina smiled, more of a grimace, really, her hare lip twisting her mouth. Tango danced and held out his arms. Edwina rattled the back door handle. Rather than unlocking the door, Sal gathered Tango's diaper bag and blanket from the back seat. Edwina poked her head in the front window and reached over to patty cake with Tango.
Bailey, put away your book and hop out, Sal said. She could smell Edwina's damp skin and felt the brush of Edwina's rayon blouse against her arm. She wanted to shove the woman's heavy shoulder, force her away.
Trevor pulled the keys from the ignition. Leland hiked his suspenders onto his shoulders and propped one hand on the car's roof.
"We thought maybe you got lost or bailed."
"We made a late start. Movers are coming tomorrow," Trevor said. Bailey scrambled out to inspect a flock of russet chickens and an imperious rooster pecking in the driveway gravel. Bailey's thin face brightened. He darted this way and that after the birds, who avoided him with light, quick steps and a great clucking. Edwina released the door lock. She lifted Tango into her arms and tickled his ribs. The first Sunday, Sal had left Tango with Leland and Edwina in the nursery. Sal was relieved. The hour alone in church gave her skin a chance to breathe. Trevor worked 100 miles away during the week, and she wore the children like tight clothing from Monday morning until he drove in on Friday night. But after Tango had stayed with Edwina for 2 or 3 Sundays, Sal had trouble prying him away. He clung to Edwina's soft, fatty neck, and she seemed gratified, perhaps even smug, that Tango preferred her. Sal slammed the car door. "He's too heavy for you, Edwina. Put him down." The scar on Edwina's lip trembled. Sal's cheeks burned, but she didn't stop. She needed to pass on the hurt. "He won't be seeing you again, and he needs to detach a little." As soon as his feet touched the ground, Tango cried, "Up, up," flexing his fingers and stretching his arms for Edwina. At the same time, the rooster, red comb and wattles swinging, extended its feathered neck and pecked Bailey on his bare calf just below his shorts. Bailey screamed and the rooster scuttled away. A dot of blood formed on Bailey's leg, and when he saw it, he began to cry. "Come on now in the house. We'll take care of it." Edwina's voice was soothing. She picked up Tango and herded Bailey ahead of her, cupping the back of his head. "Leland, you and Trevor start the barbecue." The kitchen was cool and dark. Cupboards and walls were knotty pine, the kind Sal remembered in the kitchen when she was growing up. Tears stung her eyes. There was a scent in the plaster and soft pine, a residue of bacon and spiced peaches. She blinked to clear her vision. Edwina's kitchen was outdated now. In Fresno, their house would have the latest olive green refrigerator and stove. Edwina settled Bailey on a chrome-legged chair and knelt on the cracked linoleum while she dabbed a circle of mercurochrome on his leg. After a minute or two, Bailey flexed his calf muscle and Sal sent him outside. Like he did at home, Tango tottered directly to the cupboards and pulled out the pots and pans. Sal began replacing the cookware, but Edwina shook her head. "He won't do any harm. They're all banged up. The house got hit bad in the 66 quake." From where she knelt beside Tango, Sal noticed Edwina's brown shoes run over at the heels and the thread dangling from the uneven hem of her skirt. "You were here when it happened?" "Knocked us out of bed. All the dishes fell out of the cupboards and the freezer tipped over. We lost a year's food. The foundations were damaged, and we lived in a trailer out back for 8 months." Edwina's lips tightened, and her scar stretched white. She poured 2 glasses of iced tea, carried them outside on a tray, and set them on the redwood table laid with a flowered oilcloth. Trevor had forgotten to unload Tango's playpen from the car, so Sal got it, unfolded it in the shade of an oak tree, and put Tango inside. He cried for a minute, his fingers twisted in the netting. Edwina scurried inside the house and returned with several pot lids and a nest of measuring cups. "Here, my sweet boy," she said. He thumped onto his bottom, marshaling his army of cups and lids between his spread legs. The tea was very sweet, not the way Sal liked it, but the heat made her throat dry. She drank deeply, then pressed the wet, cool glass against her bare arms. The men had lit the barbecue, a dented oil drum on iron legs, and smoke eddied around the table, keeping the flies away. Sal thought she'd seen all of it before in a dream. A smoky haze captured under the tree's canopy, coarse-bladed grass clicking against her shoes, the broken equipment, the disintegrating barn. She watched Leland and Bailey cross the green expanse of pasture, small figures from a toy farm set. Leland lifted Bailey onto the seat of a tractor with a missing front wheel. Bailey sat straight, chin up to see over the engine casing as if he were the master over 1,000 acres. He moved the steering wheel left and right. Edwina set an armful of corn on the table. "Picked an hour ago. The sugar turns to starch if you let the ears sit too long." For a few minutes, Sal leaned on her folded arms. Edwina looked up from plucking the fine silk from time to time, her eyes magnified behind her glasses. She was calm, as if Sal's hostility was a force of nature, like high wind or barley blight. The flex of Edwina's wrists and the crackle of the green husks had a pleasant rhythm, and Sal, almost against her will, joined her in stripping the ears and throwing the waste into a galvanized tub. The corn smelled moist and rich, different from frozen corn or canned corn that Sal had eaten as a girl. Her fingernail sliced a nick in a kernel, and a drop of juice beaded on the yellow surface. She sucked it, sweet as honey, off her knuckle. Edwina snapped off the tip of an ear and gave it to Tango, who gnawed the raw kernels with his 4 Bugs Bunny teeth. Edwina dropped the ears and a pile of new potatoes into a large kettle of water boiling on an outdoor camp stove. "We use this in the summer to save on electricity. The house needs to be rewired, but Leland hasn't got around to it." Edwina carried from the kitchen a basket of tomatoes, whose skins still smelled of green leaves and vines. The tomatoes were warm in her hands as Sal sliced them into a dish. When Edwina spread the lamb chops on the grill, smoke thickened overhead. The meat sizzled, and fat drippings vaporized into a burned, intoxicating smell. The scent lured Leland and Bailey to the table, where they snatched the discarded tomato ends and stuffed them in their mouths. "Butchered a lamb for this great event," Leland said, rubbing his hands together. They settled themselves on wooden benches around the table. Across the farmyard, Sal saw Trevor standing near a ramshackle pen, where he watched 2 calves lip grain from a trough. Edwina lifted the chops off the fire onto a platter and slathered Bailey's steaming corn with butter. She waved to Trevor, and after a moment, he ground out his cigarette with the toe of his shoe. When he slid into the bench beside Sal, she moved away. His weight, the sag of his arm against her shoulder, and the intrusion of his hip reminded her of Friday evenings. He'd walk in the door after being gone all week and assume she had a place for him. After her days with the children and nights listening to the wind around the house. She cut into her chop. The meat was faintly pink, and when she forked it into her mouth, the taste made her hum with pleasure. Trevor looked away. The fatty rim on the lamb. No vinegar for the tomatoes. Trevor was always dissatisfied. When they were first married, Trevor had been happier. Sal cooked like his mother. A quarter bought him a pack of cigarettes. But all the good meals, vacuumed floors, clean children, and weekend sex were not enough to keep him happy now.
"Are you all right, hon?"
Edwina touched Trevor's hand.
"Off your feed? I'll give you a dose of what I give the sheep."
Leland's Adam's apple bounced. "My ulcer." Trevor touched his chest.
"I'll cook you something else."
Edwina swung her leg over the bench.
"No, it's all right,"
Trevor said, but he left his food on his plate. Sal put her fork down. The meat was tender, the tomato slice, sugar on her tongue, but she stopped eating, as if her hunger could dissolve his discontent. After dinner, Edwina tossed the corn cobs and the uneaten food to the pigs, who grunted with delight. Tango still slept in the playpen, his lips moving for Sal's breast. She felt an ache in her nipples. Edwina untied her apron and laid it on the table.
"Let's take a walk. I want you to see something."
"I can't," Sal said. "Tango's still asleep."
"Trevor can watch him. We won't be gone long."
Edwina walked ahead, across the sheep pasture, through a grove of thick-limbed oaks. On the other side of the fence, a path climbed a series of low hills covered with sage and ripened wild oats. The fault opened some distance ahead, broken by hills and cliffs, more visible from the air, perhaps, than the ground. They entered a narrow canyon, Edwina breathing easily despite her bulk. The sun had sunk behind the hill, and they were immersed in violet shadow. The air still held the day's heat, and Sal's lungs were infused with a pungent odor of sun-saturated plants, grain, earth, and rock. Birds dotted between the branches like half-remembered thoughts. Beside the trail, sword ferns drooped over a steady trickle of water. Edwina climbed down over the rocks to the water several times to check her location. Then, with a soft "ah," she descended to the origin of the brook, where it sprang from a crack in a wall of loose granite. She breathed deeply.
"This time, it's open. It's alive."
Sal let the water spurt over her fingers. A breath ran up her spine. She'd expected the stream to be cool, but instead it was warm, as if heated by the friction of its headlong rush.
"I suppose every stream is alive in a way. Tiny plants, microscopic animals," Sal said.
"No, not like that."
Edwina was pale, her pupils large in the dim light. "Leland has visited this spring since he was a boy. The fault sealed it up in the 34 quake. It was underground for 32 years before it opened again after the 66. Sal imagined the spring, pure water seeping under tons of dirt and rock, squeezed between the layers, waiting, pressure mounting as the plates moved, until a great internal trembling released it.
"I had a miscarriage 6 weeks ago," Sal said.
Edwina's cheeks flamed, as if she'd been slapped by a cruel hand.
"Trevor was gone. The dog was outside barking at something in the dark, a raccoon maybe, or a coyote. I walked downstairs and opened the door. When I put my bare foot on the cold step, I started to bleed."
Sal rubbed her thigh with her palm, remembering how she pressed her hands between her legs to stop it, but the downward rush was inexorable.
A neighbor came to stay with Bailey and Tango. I drove myself to the hospital with a towel under me on the car seat. A tremor shook her, and she felt a movement, a painful shift of pelvis and femur, vertebrae and ribs. It was a small shift, a scrape of bone, a realignment of muscle. The water notes rose and fell. Edwina leaned over and dipped her hand in the spring. Before Sal realized it, Edwina touched her wet thumb to the tense ridges on Sal's forehead. When they arrived again at the sheep pasture, the heat had broken. Creeping darkness hid the farm's decay. The sheep clustered close together. Crickets spread a carpet of sound. A light over the back door illuminated Tango's yellow curls as he struggled to climb out of the playpen. Bailey sailed a handful of small stones into the barley field. Leland and Trevor sipped iced tea at the table, Trevor nodding occasionally as he glanced into the dark. "There's strawberry shortcake," Edwina said.
Sal's stomach growled. "That would be good. Thank you."
That was Anne DeVigo reading Fault Lines. It tells of a family of four living over at the coast. There are Sally, the mother, Sal for short, Trevor, the father, Bailey, the older son, and Tango, the baby. They're planning to move to Fresno, and so for the last time, they go to visit their old friends, Edwina and Leland, who live just about right on top of the notorious San Andreas Fault. Edwina takes Sal to see a spring, which has been dormant for 32 years, but now, all of a sudden, is spewing water again, proving that even though this natural fountain had been totally inactive for over three decades, nothing in nature is totally permanent, inasmuch as the earth is constantly evolving and changing. And that's when Sal reveals that she, too, has had a traumatic change. A miscarriage. It was just like a fault underneath the earth, she tells us, a painful shift of pelvis and femur, vertebrae, ribs, and bleeding. Friends, Anne DeVigo is a former public relations professional and award-winning journalist. She graduated from Fresno State University, has worked as a reporter for two Valley newspapers, and has had short stories of hers published in several literary journals. Thank you, Anne DeVigo, for your fine story tonight. Hope you're working on more literary prose for us for seasons to come. And now let's listen to a tale by our next author, Lucille Apcar. She entitles her story, Who Spanked J.R. Jr.? And here is Larry Patton to read it for us. Who Spanked J.R. Jr.?
Who spanked J.R. Jr. or the mysterious chastisement of the son of His Honor, the Judge? By Lucille Apgar. The Story. Fall arrived early in the year 1906, the dogwoods turning deep crimson-red, the aspens bright golden-yellow, and the big black oaks dark amber, their leaves drifting down over the schoolhouse roof and carpeting the children's playground. The school where Julia Jones, Miss Julia to her pupils and the people of Mariposa, taught. But sad to say, few paid attention to these waning glories, for Mariposa citizens stayed riveted instead upon the mystery unfolding in their little community. Much speculation abounded, and as usual in such circumstances, there were positions taken. Some sided with the pros, others with the cons. The town was agog. The weekly newspaper, The Miner, did its utmost to remain neutral. Hard to do because its editor sided with the pros, its chief and only reporter with the cons. The fact remains, it happened. But nobody knew who perpetuated this act. Who spanked J.R. Jr.? J.R. Jr. was the town's naughty boy. Only son and heir of the county's only judge, the Honorable James Rutherford Wiseman, J.R. to his friends. In the normal progression of such things, his boy became known as J.R. Jr. J.R. Jr. was not always naughty. He sometimes was honorable, although his naughtiness extended beyond the bounds of simple disobedience. He teased. He scared the girls. He plagued his teachers and played tricks on other boys. For instance, the time he put a tree frog in Billy's tomato soup. The frog didn't seem to be hurt. The soup was only lukewarm anyway, but who wants to eat soup with froggy slime in it? And the time he put a tarantula in Janie's desk, she jumped up, screamed, spilled ink all over her dress, the desk, the floor. It took the teacher ages to clean up the mess. Big splotches are still in plain sight today. Then there was that big beetle. J.R. Jr. slipped into Bobby's pants. We leave it to your imagination, the pain and humiliation suffered by that victim. In another prank, J.R. Jr. stole a bottle of his dad's whiskey and poured it down the gullets of the wild tom turkeys that roamed the school's grounds. Needless to say, the well-besotted turkeys put on a good show for J.R. Jr., although they didn't survive. Yes, J.R. Jr. could be described as a very naughty boy. But another characteristic of J.R. Jr. included a strict sense of honor. He never told tales out of school. So when he went home one day, his round 10-year-old face somewhat red, his eyes a bit swollen from crying, and displayed an inability to sit at the table, the truth came out. J.R. Jr. had received a thorough and memorable spanking. But he wouldn't say who performed this rite. The Honorable Judge J.R. Wiseman expressed outrage. Nobody, but nobody usurped his right to chastise his boy. His voice could be heard up and down Bullion Street, all the way to Charles Street and beyond. The Honorable J.R. Wiseman, endowed with a strong, resonant voice, struck fear into all offenders without exception. When he raised it in the courtroom, the walls literally vibrated. Equally sympathetic sounds emanated from the glass-paned windows. The ladies present clapped their hands to their ears. Even the sheriff's badge slipped sideways. Judge Wiseman was not tall, nor was he prepossessing at first sight. He stood about 5'6" in his socks. His features were rather irregular, with a nose that looked like it may have been broken in school athletics. His mouth, slightly off-center. J.R., however, possessed a magnificent set of vocal cords, such as could easily compete with operatic notables all the way from San Francisco in California to the famous La Scala Opera House in Milan, Italy. Summoned to his chambers were the members of the school board who numbered 3. The editor of the Mariposa Minor weekly newspaper, John Robert Burt, newsman, the owner of the hotel, Joshua Remington, Josh Bedwell, the blacksmith, Joseph Richardson, Joe Ironside. By strange coincidence, each member of the board also sported the initials J.R., although nobody thought to bestow the title J.R. to any. That, of course, was reserved for the Honorable J.R. Wiseman. Not being invited to sit, there weren't enough chairs anyway, the trustees stood, hats in hand, before his honor. "A serious breach of faith has been committed," the judge began, his voice resounding through the thin walls of the courthouse and down the corridor where the sheriff and his deputy sat, ears cocked so they could hear every word. "Apparently, one of the teachers has taken matters into his or her own hands and spanked my son." The 3 men shifted feet almost simultaneously. That each one in prior times itched to give this bad boy a sound thrashing was well known. "Junior refuses to reveal the names of his culprit, so I am forced to resort to other measures. The teacher who administered this spanking must be brought to task." The judge dismissed the small group with a wave of his hand and the words, "Bring this offender, whoever he or she is, to my courtroom, and I want no delay." The trio shuffled out with somewhat sheepish sidelong glances at each other, passing the sheriff and the deputy, both of whom looked sympathetic. Down the courthouse steps they went, just as the big clock in the tower struck the hour of 2. Out of long habit, all 3 pulled their fobs from their vest pockets to make certain the clock struck on the exact time. Under the tall cedar trees that ring the courthouse grounds, a small group of townspeople waited, each anxious to make their opinion heard. "We should question the boys one by one," said the general store manager. "Better to ask the girls. They may be more likely to talk," said another. "How about the mothers?" queried the local tavern owner. Josh Bedwell, the hotel manager, held up his hand. "First things first," he said. "We shall go to the school to talk with Miss Julia." Now, Miss Julia was not just the local school teacher. She also held the position of superintendent, which by that time in 1906 numbered 13 schools in all. They were the Cathays Valley School, Princeton School, Hornitos School, Lewis School, Ben Hur School, Buck Meadows School, Bull Creek School, Quartzsburg School, Mount Buckingham School, in addition to the Mariposa School, and that's just naming a few. With the passing of time, it has become a little obscure as to when each school was commissioned, but on average, their capacity ranged from 20 to 35 students. We must point out here that making the rounds of these schools entailed traveling for at least 2 weeks, if not 3. Sometimes Miss Julia used her father's carriage. At other times, the local stable would provide for her needs. A local teacher would provide room and board, or one of the school board members. To call it a grueling task, especially for a lone woman, would be something of an understatement. Anybody in their right and sane mind would appreciate Miss Julia. She emanated a presence. Never mind if her couture did not display the latest cut. Never mind if her laced-up shoes did not peek from under her petticoats to show the needle-pointed toes of the current fashion, a fashion, incidentally, that forced women of her day to mince and wince with every step. Never mind that her slender body gave no indication of the laces, corsetry, furbelows, and accoutrements to enhance feminine wiles and prevent unladylike strides. Never mind that her hands were rough and red from years of cleaning schoolroom desks and floors, from stoking stoves, erasing slate boards, and handling well-worn textbooks. Miss Julia could not be called a pretty woman, but in her own way her diminutive stance displayed a strength of will, a dignity and determination that well befitted her position as superintendent of 13 schools. She commanded respect. As could be expected, with school just out for the day, the three board members found Miss Julia seated at her desk, a pile of papers awaiting correction beside her. Deep in conversation with Miss Julia sat Miss Dolly, the substitute teacher who usually assumed the post during superintendent absences. Miss Dolly appeared somewhat agitated, nervously clutching a tiny embroidered handkerchief between her fingers and occasionally dabbing it to her eyes. Miss Julia, however, sat erect, spectacles in hand, unperturbed at the sight of the newcomers to whom she gestured to be seated. The tiny homemade school benches emitted some protesting creaks with the unexpected weight of the three burly men. "Gentlemen," she began, "I am well aware of the purpose of your visit. Judge Wiseman is upset, as well he might be, and I am fully prepared to take responsibility for this incident and answer any questions as to the event that has caused this uproar." She paused, placed her spectacles upon her nose, opened a manual lying upon her desk, briefly perused a few passages, and looked up again. "I will be pleased to appear before the judge as early as may be arranged. Miss Dolly will take my place in class this coming morning." And so the three board members eased their way out of the tiny classroom to report to the judge and set an early hour for the upcoming hearing. The next morning dawned bright and clear, one of those beautiful October days with a touch of frost to nip at fingers and toes. Miss Julia went about her duties as usual, rising with the first light, cleaning out the kitchen stove, setting the fire with kindling gathered from under the oaks and cedars, and preparing a simple breakfast meal. That accomplished, she set out on foot to her school. In addition to their classroom duties, every teacher's task included straightening desks, washing chalk from the board, dusting off benches, clearing litter and sweeping out leaves blown into the room by the fall winds. The schoolroom seemed cool enough to need a small fire in the pot-bellied stove, and this she accomplished with the supply of wood thoughtfully placed in the bin by one of her students. Following this, she placed upon each desk the student assignments for the day, as well as corrected papers from previous lessons. On the teacher's desk, she placed the agenda for Miss Dolly to follow, and textbooks neatly stacked in the order in which they were to be used. No sooner were all chores completed when the door opened to admit the three trustees who planned to accompany her to the courthouse for her appearance before Judge Wiseman. The courtroom, even at that early hour of 9 o'clock, was already crowded with townspeople, parents, shopkeepers, onlookers. Every bench appeared full, with some even forced to stand along the rear wall and all the way down the narrow staircase. With her usual aplomb, Miss Julia entered, made her way to the solid oaken chair facing the judge's bench, her demeanor quiet and unruffled. Not being a formal docketed hearing, the usual preliminaries were waived as Judge Wiseman entered. However, out of habitual respect, the room immediately hushed as he took his position upon the bench. The judge, his deep, sonorous voice unusually gentle, began by addressing the small figure of Miss Julia now standing before him. "It has come to my attention," he began, "that a certain member of the school staff has taken it upon his or herself to administer a punishment on my boy. I have been given to understand, Miss Julia, that you are prepared to reveal the name of this transgressor."
"Yes, Your Honor, I am," replied Miss Julia, "and I am that person you seek."
A gasp went up from the audience, followed by an immediate buzz of half-whispered conversation. "Silence!" roared the judge. The courtroom walls vibrated, the window panes rattled, and the sheriff clutched his badge. Miss Julia, undeterred by this commotion, continued,
"I determined your son to be in violation as described in the Manual of Student Discipline, and I rendered appropriate punishment as prescribed. With your Honor's permission, I will describe this offense to the court."
The judge nodded in assent.
"The incident occurred shortly after close of classes for the day. As I sat correcting papers, there seemed to be some commotion behind the old barn at the edge of the property, and I set out to investigate. Apparently your son and two collaborators were engaged in smoking a cheroot between them. I was unable to determine the identities of the other two as they ran away when I approached. I could only view their backs. However, your son not only waved the cheroot towards my direction, but spoke with the utmost impudence."
Miss Julia paused. "What words did he use?" the judge insisted.
"He said, if I recall the exact words, 'Hi, you old Julia, old girl.'"
Miss Julia hesitated, her face a little flushed, then continued, holding up a document as she spoke.
"The action I took is prescribed on page 5 of the manual. I removed the cheroot, stamped it on the ground, grasped the young man by his right ear, and made him accompany me into the school room where I administered the 10 lashes.
After a slight pause, she added,
"For good measure, I may have extended the punishment by 1 or 2 strokes.
Titters and snickers came from the audience. Now, it is a well-known fact that a judge reaches his elevated position in a number of ways, in most cases by reputation as a fair and just arbiter who tempers the letter of the law with an understanding of human nature. Such certainly could be said of the Honorable Judge Wiseman. For all his outbursts and occasional expressions of annoyance, he could be described as a man who gave much thought to his decisions." The courtroom remained silent as the judge pondered Miss Julia's disclosure, studied the manual placed before him, and wrote a few notes on his pad. He looked up.
"Miss Julia," he said, "the actions you took are entirely appropriate. I was fully prepared to insist upon your dismissal for demonstrating such audacity as spanking my son, but I find you acted well within your authority. If my son merited such punishment, I would have taken similar action had I found myself in the same circumstance."
The judge paused for a moment and continued,
"I applaud your straightforward answers."
Judge Wiseman then turned to the crowded courtroom and raised his voice slightly.
"We in Mariposa are indebted to this woman who dedicates her life to the education of our children. Not just Miss Julia, but all those who serve in our schools. Her agreement with our county stipulates she may not marry over the term of the contract, and she made a choice between motherhood of a few and a teacher and mentor to the many. Without our teachers, you, Mr. Bedwell, would not be capable of operating a hotel. You, Mr. Newsman, of preparing a weekly journal. No profession could exist without a teacher to make it possible. I, for one, recognize that fact. Here and now, and I hope I speak for everyone in this room, I express my undying gratitude. With that, the judge rose and commenced clapping his hands. The entire assembly followed suit. And as Miss Julia left the courtroom, the sound of applause followed her all the way as she walked down the road leading to her school.
That was Larry Patton reading Who Spanked J.R. Jr., written by Lucille Abkar. As we heard, it's a story about the mischievous son of a most respected judge, the Honorable James Rutherford Wiseman. After catching his son smoking a cheroot, which is slang for a cigar, his teacher, Miss Julia, administers a paddling as legally prescribed in the school's discipline manual. Well, everybody thought the judge would really come down on her for doing that to his own son. But after being presented with the facts and the evidence, the judge realizes that she only did what she was supposed to do. So instead of being angry with her, well, the judge thanked her and all the other teachers for their service and devotion. Friends, Lucille Abkar is a published author, having collaborated on a collection of short stories under the title of From the Book of 1,000 Tales. It deals mostly with stories about the Armenian Genocide. We want to thank both of our authors, Anne DeVigo and Lucille Abkar, for their stories tonight, and of course, hope they'll be sending us more of their work in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read stories again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our author will be Oscar G. Williams. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.